It sure is, with our special guest tonight, astrophysicist J. Richard Gott, with his two books, Sizing Up the Universe, Time Travel and Einstein's Universe. We're going to spend some time now talking about time travel. So get ready. Don't disappear on us. Don't go off into another dimension. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast, J. Richard Gott. Richard, your thoughts on time travel. Possible one day?
Well, one thing people should know is that time travel to the future, which is the subject of many science fiction books, you'd like to visit the future, not only is this known to be possible, but people are actually doing it in a small way today. Einstein proved in special relativity in 1905 that moving clocks tick slowly, and this was has been verified by flying an airplane around the world going east, so that its velocity adds to the velocity of the Earth. And so when it comes back, it's like 56 nanoseconds slow relative to one that had stayed on the ground, just like Einstein predicted. So this has actually been verified. We see that elementary particles that are going near the speed of light, these decay more slowly than they would if they were sitting in the lab. So we know that moving clocks tick slowly, and there's the biggest, so all you have to do if you want to visit the Earth, let's say, in the year 3000, is get on a rocket, go at 99.995% the speed of light out to Betelgeuse, which is 500 light years away, and come back. And it'll take you 500 years to get out there, 500 years to get back, but because you're going near the speed of light, you will only age 10 years. So when you come back, you'll find the Earth 1,000 years in the future, and you will have only aged 10 years on your spaceship. Now, we have an astronaut today, Sergei Krikalev, who, by virtue of 6 space flights and going about 17,000 miles per hour in orbit around the Earth, he has aged 1/48 of a second less than he would have if he'd stayed on the Earth. So that means that when he comes back to the Earth at the end, he finds the Earth 1/48 of a second in the future of where he expected it to be.
Isn't time travel too? Like when I travel from St. Louis to L.A., I save time. I pick up 2 hours.
Well, that's a time zone.
Yeah.
Yes, you can go across the date line and so forth. But that's a man-made invention, you know. I mean, we could all be on the same time. We could all be on Greenwich Mean Time, you know, and use the British standard, and then we'd have one time zone in the whole world. But this is really going toward the future in a way that's as real as the fantastic voyage of going 1,000 years in the future. It's a small amount that we've gone. 1/48 of a second. I know she laughed when I said the 48th of a second. And that's because that's rather small. But someone asked me once, they said, well, so why is it so hard to travel in time when it's easy to travel in space? And I said, well, no, actually, we haven't been much further in space. The furthest we've been out is to the moon, and that's 1.3 light seconds away. Einstein taught us that we should compare distances in space with times by using the speed of light. So we say that Alpha Centauri is 4 light years away because it takes light 4 years to get here from Alpha Centauri. So the most distant we've ever been is the moon. That's 1.3 light seconds. So we've gone 1.3 light seconds in space and 1/48 of a second in time. So Mr. Krikalev, who's this astronaut time traveler, he's made a voyage in time about as long as Lindbergh's voyage in space was across the Atlantic Ocean. It takes light about 1/48 of a second to go across the Atlantic Ocean. So we've traveled kind of a similar amount in time, and it's just because of the fact that we're traveling at a low velocity relative to the velocity of light. You increase the NASA budget and let us travel faster, and we will travel more toward the future than we have done.
Did you see the movie Avatar?
Yes.
What'd you think of that?
I loved it. I thought that Cameron's a genius, you know.
He's been on the show. I wish I had you on when we had Cameron on. When we get him back, because he's writing some sequels to that.
Oh,
but
yeah.
He is. He is a genius.
Yes. And I love the 3D stuff. In fact, in the Sizing Up the Universe, Bob Vanderbilt, my co-author, and I, we decided that we should have some 3D pictures in the book. So we've got 3D pictures of some of these Great Wall structures. We've got 3D pictures of orbits in the solar system and Saturn's rings. And so I thought the 3D thing really made you feel like you were there. Avatar is very interesting for the following reason. It takes place on Alpha Centauri, supposedly. Mm-hmm. There's a planet there. We really do find Jupiter-like planets orbiting other stars. Avatar planet Pandora is actually a moon orbiting this Jupiter-sized planet. You can see the Jupiter-sized planet way up there in the sky. It's like 40 degrees across in the sky.
And a quick question about that. When we say Jupiter-sized planets, they're gas planets, which means how big is the solid portion of the planet?
Well, it's smaller. I mean, Jupiter has a sort of metallic core. The gas giant planets, it's considerably smaller, and it sort of just meshes into a metallic core. But most of the volume of it is gas.
I mean, does it have like a little surface, or could there be, you know, things on it, mountains and things like that?
Well, the pressure down there is so large, you really don't think of it as a surface. The atmosphere just gets thicker and thicker and thicker. And so we sort of mark the visible surface of Jupiter where you get to about one Earth atmosphere pressure. So the planet that people look up in the sky and see in Avatar is about like Jupiter. Now, one thing that happens in the movie that was kind of interesting to me is that this Jupiter would be very bright. I mean, it's much bigger than the full moon. The full moon is a half a degree across. This is obviously like 40 degrees across. So it's like 40, more than 40 squared times 4. It's 4 times 40 squared times more light than the moon. And Jupiter is more reflective than the moon. So in Avatar, it's shown as nighttime, and he's using at night. He's getting a torch out so he can see, and then there's this Jupiter softly glowing up there in the sky. It would actually be a lot brighter than that, because they're about the same distance from the sun as we are in the movie. Otherwise, the temperature wouldn't be right on the Pandora planet. So that's one interesting thing. But the movie brings up a very interesting point. And that is that we're seeing a number of planets that are around low luminosity stars, red dwarf stars like Gliese 581. And if you're in the habitable zone of one of those low luminosity stars, you have to be pretty close to the planet, to the star. And that means that you'll be so close that your planet would likely be tidally locked to the star, like the moon is locked to the Earth, so that the moon always shows the same face to the Earth because of the tides that the Earth exerts on the moon. So the situation that we would have is that if we have a planet that's orbiting a low-mass star, we might expect it to keep the same face always to that star. And that means you got one side of the planet's too hot and the other side of the planet's too cold. But if you have a moon that goes around one of those Jupiter-sized planets, that moon is orbiting the Jupiter-sized planet. It's so close to its Jupiter-sized planet that it's tidally locked, so that it always keeps the same face toward the Jupiter-sized planet. But the fact, so if you look up in the sky from Pandora, you'd always see Jupiter, the Jupiter-sized thing, hanging up there in the sky in the same location. But since you're going around, the orbiting around every few days, so you're orbiting around this Jupiter-sized planet, the sun is going to rise and set, and you're going to go into eclipse past your Jupiter-sized planet. So half the time you're facing the sun, and half the time you're not. So you get a night and day, and you get a nice temperatures then. So a moon, curiously, going around a Jupiter-sized planet, as is depicted in Avatar, is a more habitable location than, and if it's a small mass star, than it would be if it was just by itself, because then one side of the planet would be facing the star and the other side would be in permanent night.
You know, Jay, this whole thing of time travel is remarkable, as people, I think, one day will attempt all kinds of things. We get stories, as you well know, on Coast to Coast all the time from people who have claimed to have been time travelers. There's a case out there by a guy named John Teeter who seems to have disappeared, who came from 2034, and he's posted on the internet. But what's so cool about all that is a lot of the things they say are pretty compelling. You know, it's almost as if they have Leonardo da Vinci brains of the future, where they're able to see things that a lot of people don't. And I just wonder if one day we'll really have the physical ability to do that, like the old movie, The Time Machine, where you sit in some apparatus and off you go. I don't know if that'll ever happen or not.
Well, one of the things we've discovered is that we talked about time travel to the future. Time travel to the future, we know, is possible. It's just a matter of getting a fast enough spaceship and going on a long enough trip and coming back to the Earth. You can visit as far in the future as you want. It just costs a lot of money, a lot of energy. The big question that people are investigating is whether there's possible, under the laws of physics, to do time travel to the past. And here again, Einstein's theory of general relativity has come into play. This is his theory in 1915, where he said curved space-time explains gravity. And light should be bent going around the sun. He proved that he made a prediction as to how much light should be bent going around the sun. He was vindicated. Newton's prediction was wrong by a factor of two. So Einstein's theory of curved space-time has replaced Newton's theory of gravity. It makes predictions that have been verified and verified now many times. A remarkable thing, because Newton's theory of gravity was the most amazing theory that we'd had. It explained all sorts of things in the solar system. But Einstein's theory explained a peculiarity in the orbit of Mercury, that it was precessing, its elliptical orbit was precessing as it went around the sun. And so it gave the correct prediction. Newton did not. So this is our best theory of gravity, is general relativity. Now, it was understood from early on that in special relativity, that if you could somehow go faster than the speed of light, you could travel back in time. In fact, there's a poem. There was a young lady named Bright. She traveled far faster than light. She left one day in a relative way and returned home the previous night. So if you could go faster than the speed of light, you could go back in time. However, Einstein showed that you couldn't build a rocket that would go faster than the speed of light. However, there's a loophole in this. In his theory of general relativity, you can take a shortcut through curved space-time by either going through a wormhole or going around a cosmic string, and you can beat a light beam going the regular way. So if you can beat a light beam in your spaceship, and you can move your cosmic strings around in the appropriate way, or move your wormholes around in the appropriate way, you can build a time machine that will actually allow you to visit the past. Now, one of the things that we've found out about this is that you can only use the time machine to go back to epochs when the time machine was in existence. So what happens is that you build a time machine by warping space and time twisting space and time, building a loop in time, so to speak. And then you can go back as long as that loop was in existence. So let's say you build a time machine in the year 3000 by having moving cosmic strings. There's a loop in time that's created, sort of like a loop-the-loop that occurs on a roller coaster. The roller coaster is always going forward, but it goes forward in time, but it goes around a loop and comes back to where it was. This is like Magellan's crew going around the Earth, going west all the time, and then finding themselves back in Europe. This could only occur with a curved surface of the Earth. So with curved space-time, the time traveler can go always forward toward the future, he thinks, but loop around in a loop and come back to the same event where he was before. And that allows time travel to the past. But if you build a time machine up in the year 3000, you can only use the time machine to go back to when the time machine, back as early as the year 3000. So if you build a time machine in the year 3000, you might use it to go from 3002, but back to 3001, but you can't use it to come back before the year 3000 when you built the time machine. So that's sufficient to explain why we're not, let's say, overrun with time traveler tourists at the Kennedy assassination and other events. Yeah. Where are all the, you know, people in the, you know, silver suits and the camcorders in the Kennedy assassination? It would be a popular, interesting event to go see and find out about. And we don't see them there. But we wouldn't expect to see any time travelers until someone has actually built a time machine. But then they can show up for the first time. And so whether you can build these time machines, it seems to depend on the understanding quantum gravity. This is how gravity behaves at microscopic scales. But when H.G. Wells wrote his epic book, The Time Machine, at that time, when he wrote that book in 1895, they had the laws of physics, or Newton's laws of physics. Under Newton's laws of physics, time travel was absolutely impossible to the future or to the past. And he wrote this book about traveling in time. And by 1905, which is 10 years later, Einstein was proving that time travel to the future was possible. And then by 1949, Kurt Gödel had found a time machine solution to Einstein's theory of general relativity, and I found one in 1991. Kip Thorne found one in 1988. There have been several time machines that we found in general relativity. But now the situation we have is that the laws of physics as we understand them today, Einstein's theory of general relativity, and seems to allow time travel. And so we're asking the question, will we discover anything in the future that might prevent it? And quantum gravity might prevent it, but it might be helpful to it in a way also, because it helps to prevent singularities because things get blurred out by quantum effects. So we don't know the answer to that question, but it's very interesting to try to understand whether time travel to the past is possible. These are all problems that super civilizations could attempt. My cosmic string time machine weighs about half the mass of the galaxy, and Kip Thorne's wormhole solutions weigh about 200 million solar masses. So these are not things that you're making in your garage, but these are things that we'd like to know whether a civilization, however advanced, might be able to do this sort of thing, and whether or not the universe might naturally create some time machines of its own.
Jay, let's talk about the time travel in general, and because to me, time is physical. It's gone. The event is gone, but maybe it isn't. And then we'll talk about the multiverse on Coast to Coast AM. Are you a Coast Insider, a Streamlink member? You can be for just pennies a day and take advantage of all credible little perks. And yes, they're working on the Android. As a matter of fact, my tech boys emailed me a little note today. So So they're working on that very diligently. I told them end of November, they're trying to get some kinks out of it. Apparently the iPhone apps are much easier, but the Android X and the Android apps are coming as long and BlackBerry as well. Have patience. We'll come back and take more questions with J. Richard Gott. Phone calls next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. So if they build this machine, how would they build it, Richard? I mean, what kind of parts do you need for something like that?
Well, the if you're building one of these cosmic string time machines, you need some cosmic string loop. Cosmic strings are predicted by about half our theories of particle physics, and they're threads of high-energy material for left over from the very early universe, from a vacuum state in the very early universe. So it's kind of like if you have a snowfall and the snow melts everywhere except there's a few snowmen left standing. The strings are vacuum, high-density vacuum from the early universe left over from the very early days. So you get one of these loops, and it will naturally contract like a rubber band, and you just have to manipulate it a little bit with some massive spaceships to make it collapse in just the right way so that two of the string loop parts pass each other at high speed. You can make them pass at such a high speed that they should create a time machine. If it's doing that, though, it's in danger, I showed, of falling into a black hole. So if you want to use this time machine, you may go in, go around the string loops, and come back and visit an old event in your own past. You may be able to say hello to an earlier self. But when you do that, you'll be inside a black hole. So there's no getting back out to brag to your friends about your adventures. And you may be killed by a singularity afterwards. Maybe you'll pop out into another universe if you're lucky. You may be killed before you can do the time travel.
Yeah, that's
true. This is what we're trying to understand.
The multiverse seems to be on the minds of many astronomers and physicists these days. What created that thought? Had we talked about this, Jay, 20 years ago, people would have said, you're nuts. There's one universe, that's it. Now, a lot of people, maybe the majority, are talking about multiverses.
Well, it's because of the theory of inflation. Inflation explains how the Big Bang got started. This repulsive gravitational force in the early universe caused the universe to expand faster and faster and faster. It explains why the universe is very big, because inflation doubles the size of the universe over and over and over again. And we observe that the universe is very flat, just like it's like you're looking at the surface of the Earth, and the Earth is so much larger than you are that it looks flat. So we see the portion of the visible universe that we can see out to 13.7 billion light years away looks very flat. That gives us the idea that the universe is very much larger than the part we can see. Also, inflation predicts, Linde showed, that inflationary cosmologies can give birth to other inflating universes. And so this is like an expanding branch. Branches can grow off of it and become expanding universes of their own. And then those branches give birth to other branches, ad infinitum. And so you eventually get an infinite fractal tree of expanding branching universes, and this makes for a multiverse. And the reason we take this seriously is that that same theory that predicts this multiverse also predicts the detailed fluctuations that we see in the microwave background that we can measure and that agree rather perfectly with what inflation predicts. So we take that seriously because we observe things that it is predicted successfully ahead of time, by the way, I should say. And then you see that theory is confirmed. And so then you look at the implications of that theory. It looks like a multiverse is a pretty clear implication of inflation. And these are so far away that we're never going to see them because the light traveling from them, they're expanding so fast the distance between them is so large, and that space between us and them is stretching so fast that the light beam is just not ever going to wend its way to us. And this is not violating special relativity, because space itself can stretch faster than a light beam can cross the distance between the two points. So that's why we're talking about many, many multiverses.
Your co-author, Bob Vanderbilt, he took some pictures from his backyard in New Jersey that you say rival some of our great observatories. How in the heck did he do that? What's he got back there, a 90-inch telescope?
Well, no, he has about a 10-inch diameter telescope. He's taking advantage of a great thing that's been invented, the CCD camera. We all have these. They're very good collectors of photons. They're about 100 times more efficient than photographic film. And so you can make a faint exposure. The problem with observing in New Jersey is that the sky is rather bright. The atmosphere is rather bright. But if you're taking a picture of a nebula, you can put a filter in front of it that will just let through the light that's coming from a particular spectral line that's being emitted by that nebula. Say, for example, hydrogen alpha light, which is a particular wavelength in the red. So he can take a picture, and it filters out all of the light from the atmosphere, most all of it, and it just lets through the light that the nebula is making. So in the book, we show, for example, a picture he took of the Eagle Nebula. He took it at two spectral lines, the hydrogen alpha and the oxygen 3. It's a beautiful picture of the Eagle Nebula. We put it right up next to a picture of the best picture ever of the Eagle Nebula, which was made by the Hubble Space Telescope. And the Hubble Space Telescope is better, but Bob's is surprisingly good next to it. And his picture's in red looking because he's got the proper colors. The Hubble Space Telescope picture is a green. They've used three wavelengths, and they've sort of made a false color picture. But Bob's picture is truer to the actual colors. That nebula really is red looking because most of the light's coming out in hydrogen alpha light. So here we have and various pictures that Bob has taken that are really spectacular. And the reason this is worth mentioning to people listening in is that used to astronomy was a backyard hobby. When I was growing up, there wasn't that much light pollution, and people would take their telescope out in the backyard, and they could see things. They could see planets and the moon and galaxies and nebula in their backyard. The light pollution has interfered with looking at some of those faint objects, but now digital cameras have come back in, and so you're now able to take digital pictures of some of these objects from your backyard that are amazing and may help to make astronomy a backyard hobby again, not something that you have to go 100 miles out into the woods and find a really dark site. That's nice to do. And people should also know that they're great pictures. It's possible to take terrific pictures of the planets, too. We have some pictures in there that Bob took of the planets. And here, the advance is that the trouble with looking at planets is that the atmospheric scene makes them wobble and blurry and so forth. And here, we have the ability now, with the digital cameras, to take a video of many, many frames of that planet, and then there's software that will pick out the rare clear ones and add those up and make a picture of, say, Jupiter or Mars that are much better than you could see even with your eye looking through the telescope. So these are advances that have made astronomy maybe a backyard hobby again, and people who are interested in computers and like taking digital pictures and putting them on their computer can find that there's opportunities for seeing some of the wonders of the universe from the backyard. I've I've gone all around the world, and I've seen many of the wonders of the world, from the Taj Mahal to the Grand Canyon, to the the outback of Australia from the air and so forth. And I love taking pictures of them, even though there's many pictures of them that exist. I love taking my own pictures. Well, Bob can take pictures of the wonders of the universe right from his backyard. And we would hope that some of the people looking at many of the beautiful pictures in our book might be encouraged to take up astronomy as a backyard hobby.
I remember two things. One, when my folks bought me my first Tasco telescope, and I joined a telescope club that the shop owner had, and he had spray painted my wooden tripod black with then little white specks so they looked like stars. and he did it with like fluorescent paint. So if you put a light on it at night, it truly looked like your telescope is floating on stars. I mean, and we would meet weekly, and I remember, Jay, the first time I looked at Jupiter, and I could see the four moons with a telescope, and I looked at Mars. But when I saw Saturn sitting there with those rings, like it was just painted out there on a canvas, I couldn't believe it.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, I was hooked. I was raised in Detroit, so I would get up. It would be 10 degrees out in the winter, and I'd go out there and haul this thing out there and set it up. And it was an easy telescope, too. You just had a little viewfinder, and you had your telescope, and it was done. The newer ones are a little more sophisticated, and you got to study them in order to get them to work the way you want. But it was something else. It really was.
Seeing Saturn in the rings is one of the terrific experiences. It makes me think of the fact that we, in our new book, we talk about a new theory of Saturn's rings that I have worked on with my co-author, Bob Vanderbilt, and also Ed Belbruno. The standard picture of Saturn's rings, ever since I was grown up and all the way until quite recent times, has been that Saturn's rings were caused when a moon of Saturn's wandered inside the Roche limit, and it was ripped apart by the tidal forces of Saturn. If you get too close to Saturn, the tidal forces will rip an object apart. And so there are the Saturn's rings sitting just inside the Roche limit. So the idea was that an errant moon had come in, ripped apart, and then the debris was the rings that you see. And when we were looking at it, I had the idea, and I worked on it with these two people, that it was the opposite thing going on. Originally, Saturn had a big set of rings that went all the way out to its moon Titan, much bigger than the set of rings that we see today, that were icy particles. And outside of Roche limit, those icy particles could coagulate into moons. Gravity would pull them together, and they would collide with each other, and you'd form moons. But inside the Roche limit, the tidal forces prevented you from forming a moon, so you just never formed one. They would rip apart anything that tried to form. So that Saturn's rings are actually old. They're the remnants of the rings that were originally there. And so what we're seeing today, there are no errant moons. All the moons going around Saturn are going around nice circular orbits, and so are the ring particles. So we're looking at something that's old, and the Cassini probe, originally they thought the rings were young because they didn't have enough dust on them that they'd accumulated over the eons. But now they've discovered that the rings are sufficiently dense so that the particles will be hitting each other, breaking each other apart, these icy particles exposing fresh ice so that there's not as much dust. So now they also agree that it's old. This is what our theory would say. So when you're looking at Saturn's rings, you may well be looking at something that's about as old as Saturn itself. Particles that never got themselves together in a moon because they're too close to Saturn.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, wonders of the universe to be sure. Now, how did it all start, Jay? How did it all start? It's way too vast.
Well, inflation tells you how the Big Bang got started. It was just this repulsive gravitational effect of the vacuum energy density that was there in the early universe. Inflation allows universes to create other universes, as I said. So you have this infinite fractal tree of universes. The branches grow up to be as big as the trunk. They sprout branches of their own. The branches sprout branches. They grow up, and so we're just one of the branches. But still, it does cause people to ask, so where did this first trunk come from?
Exactly.
Where did that first trunk come from?
I happen to think that the universe might be God all by itself, and that it's self-created.
Well, we looked at a theory that Li Jingli and I were trying to explain how the trunk got there. And one of the pictures that we have, we don't know the answer to this, but one of the hypotheses that people have made, this was made by Alex Vilenkin and also Stephen Hawking and Hartle, that the universe simply popped into existence. By quantum tunneling, and it came out of nothing. And Li Jingli and I thought that was a little hard to do because, well, it wasn't really nothing. It had to be nothing that knew all about the laws of quantum mechanics.
And exactly.
How does nothing know about quantum mechanics? And you're trying to make the universe out of something that doesn't exist, and so forth. So
it'll push you over the edge, you know. Trying to think of it.
Yes. And so Li Jingli and I said, well, what if the universe wasn't made out of nothing? Suppose the universe was made out of something. And what could it be made out of? Well, maybe it could be made out of itself, because inflation has this interesting property that it blows up and it makes a real, you start with a little tiny inflating piece, and it blows up into a big inflating piece, and little bits of which look just like the bit that you started with. So what if one of those little bits at the end was actually the bit that you started with? How could you do that? Well, with the time travel. In other words, we had the picture, Li Jingli and I had the picture, and we have a beautiful picture of this in the Sizing Up the Universe book. You have a branches coming off this tree. And what if one of the branches simply curved back around and grew up to be the trunk itself? Suppose one of the branches curled back in time and grew up to be the trunk. So it looks like the loop at the bottom of the numeral 6. So that branches off, goes back around, and grows up to become the trunk. This is possible in general relativity. It allows the universe to be its own mother. And so it's a self-creating universe. So there's a little time loop there. And if you go around this, the branch is small, it grows up bigger, it becomes the trunk, then the branch branches off the trunk, and then up further up, then the trunk has above that, at the top of the numeral 6, there are more branches and more branches, and it just keeps on branching, you get a big tree. So this model was very interesting in that it explained a number of things. One of the things that it explained was why we have an arrow of time. We notice that if we send photons out, we shake charges here. Photons go out at the speed of light, and they get to Alpha Centauri 4 years later. We don't see them when we shake a charge here. We don't see photons intersecting Alpha Centauri 4 years ago. We don't see light coming from Alpha Centauri and coming together whenever we shake a charge. This means that photons only go toward the future. They don't go toward the past. And how do you explain this time asymmetry? Because the laws of physics, the general relativity and everything, they're time symmetric. So the only way to explain that is really with something about the initial conditions of the universe. So
let's talk more about that, Richard, when we come right back. Plus, we'll take phone calls. Fascinating discussion with J. Richard Gott. on Coast to Coast AM.